Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. As we return to our podcasting for 2017, the government is limping through the first week of the parliament. The summer brought an entitlement scandal that cost a minister her job, a dramatic clash between President Trump and Malcolm Turnbull, and just this week, Cory Bernardi moving from the Liberal Party to the crossbenchers to begin his new Conservative Party. To discuss the government's course, we're joined by one of its most senior figures, Arthur Sinodinos, who in the January reshuffle moved to industry, science and innovation. Arthur Sinodinos, does Cory Bernardi's defection from the Liberal Party reflect serious disillusionment among the party's Conservative base?
Well, as far as I'm aware, Cory's the only person who's walked, and others like Erica Betts have put out statements saying that they're going to stay inside the Liberal Party. Now, Eric's a well-known Conservative, so I suppose different people make different judgments about these things. As far as I'm concerned, the government will get on with its agenda.
But what about the base? Because what Senator Bernardi is saying is that many in the base are not happy.
Well, what I'd say to Senator Bernardi is if you want to influence the party, you've got to be inside the party. You can't do it from outside.
Do you think this new party that he's setting up will garner votes, or do you think it'll be just a flash in the pan, he'll get publicity now and then he'll basically disappear electorally as opposed to in the parliament?
Look, I don't know, but it's a pretty crowded marketplace these days, and with modern technology and everything else, there are a lot of people out there, citizen journalists, citizen everything, using their phones to do all sorts of things, so we'll wait and see what happens. But he's got some pretty formidable players out there, like Pauline Hanson, who has a very high profile and a lot of street cred as an outsider.
And just on Pauline Hanson, we're coming up now to two state elections, Western Australia and Queensland, which will test her vote. How do you assess her clout at the moment? She's got 8%, I think it is, in this week's news poll nationally. It's a pretty high vote.
I think she has got a high profile. She has been garnering that grievance vote, if you like, a bit like Clive Palmer did in 2013. So we'll have to wait and see. But my experience of these things, going back 20 years to when Pauline Hanson first came on the scene, is that she promises a lot, but things always fall apart because she has no answers to the fundamental questions.
It can be fairly painful, though, for the Conservative side of politics while they're falling apart. I mean, we just have to think of the Queensland election back in those days where she got a lot of seats.
Well, I think our job, based on that experience, is to keep explaining to people why our policies will deliver the sort of economic and social outcomes that she can't. We did it 20 years ago, we can do it again.
Now, just on Cory Bernardi, you're obviously in the Senate, so you'll be dealing with a former colleague in a new position on the crossbench. How do you think that this departure from the Liberal Party will affect the dynamics in the Senate? Do you think basically it'll be much the same, or will he be more inclined to desert coalition positions?
Well, I would expect on most things that he would support coalition policy. He was actually elected on a coalition platform, and I think if he's going to keep faith with those voters, he should support coalition positions.
You don't think he'll play too tough in negotiations?
He's a crossbencher that they all want to negotiate, and that's fair enough. But he was elected on a coalition platform. I expect he would support coalition policy.
In general, the government seems to be pushing into very severe headwinds as we go into this year. Are people's perceptions, the public perceptions, being set in such a way that it's going to be really hard to turn them around, even though there's a long way to go till the election?
Well, I think the latter is the point. There's a long way to go to the election. It's funny how quickly things erupt and then subside and we move on to the next thing. So my view is, that you can't rule any possibilities out, including the possibility that the government actually goes from strength to strength as we go forward. Yes, there are testing headwinds, including the national environment, but we're going to be very keen to prosecute the case for economic growth, for jobs, for why international trade is a good thing for everybody, not just one country. So yes, there are challenges ahead, but that also creates opportunities.
But there are a couple of problems, aren't there? You talk about jobs and growth, and of course we heard all that in the election campaign and the months later. Do you think that ordinary people in the electorate just sort of turn off and think, well, these are words, these are slogans?
Well, I think we have to do more work in explaining why particular policies are leading to good local outcomes. So there's going to be more focus this year by ministers and through their departments and their programs in explaining the benefits that flow through from particular initiatives to people at the local level. You saw a version of that at the press club where the Prime Minister talked about the benefit that would flow through to workers from having lower taxes on companies and therefore lower taxes on jobs. So there's going to be a lot more of that explanation occurring, and why things like innovation, new products, new processes, new ways of doing things lead to better local outcomes. And so we're going to be using a lot more of the case studies which are out there about why all these things are happening and which flow from good policies. Free trade is another area where there's a huge number of examples of things which are now happening because markets have opened up.
But if we take those benefits that he mentioned from a company tax cut, that was a few hundred dollars that a worker on average earnings would be better off in, what, a decade or two?
Well, the issue when you cut taxes on companies and jobs is you have to give some certainty over the long term that something will happen, because that is the time frame over which people make investment decisions. And yes, it is a longer term time frame, but if we could afford to give people a $750 a week or a year tax cut now, well, we would, but we can't. So we have to be able to do budget repair while putting in place good policies that lead to good outcomes. But we have to be, I think the public will accept that a benefit may be in the future if they understand how that benefit occurs and why it's a good thing.
Not perhaps if they've become really cynical about the political process, though, and they're told that they'd get a benefit over the long term, but they're really focused on their cost of living here and now.
That's true, and that's why we've had to, I think, be very clear this year in saying that one of our priorities is to address cost of living concerns, including in relation to energy, the affordability of energy, while also securing energy sources and reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. So energy policy featured quite prominently in the Prime Minister's speech last week for the very reason you mentioned. The cost of living is a concern. Energy is an important part of that.
Well, talking about energy, he opened up this question of new electricity generation through clean coal. But surely there was a problem with this. Firstly, the energy sector reacted sceptically, and the financiers also seemed to have great doubts. And secondly, if a Liberal government has to subsidise clean coal generation, isn't that against all your principles against corporate welfare?
The first point is to go back to where this all began. Because of issues that particularly erupted last year in South Australia with the blackouts, it became clear to us, because it became clear to the public, blackouts are clearly unacceptable, that energy security was a very important matter. So what we had underestimated in the transition to renewals was the need to maintain that continuity of baseload power on the way through as you accommodate more and more renewables on the system, which otherwise can be volatile and lead to discontinuities in power supply. So what we've had to do is look at a longer-term plan, which is what we're putting together now, which tries to address energy security and at the same time reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. Now, as part of that, we're looking at low-emission technologies. And what we're saying is, certainly the Prime Minister said last week, I'm taking a technology-agnostic approach to this. We look across the board at what are technologies to lower emissions, and then generally available programs that people can access can be potentially used to help fund those sorts of low-emission technologies being implemented. So he wasn't talking about doing something special for just one technology. The whole point of a technology agnostic approach is to provide a framework for what options are available, and then there are generally available mechanisms of assistance. People compete, and the best technologies with the best trade-off in terms of lower emissions for the cost involved will get funded.
But the argument seems to be that...
But Michelle, sorry, on the subsidies issue, what we're talking about here is we're dealing with an externality called greenhouse gases. So as a community, we've made a decision to get them down because of their longer-term impacts. So governments are forced to intervene to put in place policies to do something the market itself would not do. So what we're talking about here is having public policies which provide a framework in which low-emission technologies can be adopted.
Wouldn't it be better to do more work on making more gas available, for example, transition
and
period?
We're doing that simultaneously. That's why we're talking to the states through the Council of Australian Governments about incentives for gas exploration and development. It's a difficult issue. You've seen what's happened in New South Wales and Victoria. So it's not just one side of politics. Both sides of politics have been hit on the ground by the Lock the Gate movement and others who are trying to stop development of conventional and unconventional gas onshore. And the challenge for us as a federal government is how do we work with state governments to remove some of the concerns which are stopping the development of those resources? Because what's happened is the resources which are available increasingly have been diverted for international export, international production, where the returns are much higher, and that is putting pressure on domestic prices. As industry minister, I've got to be concerned about major energy-intensive industries, whether it's the chemical and feedstock industries, for example, and other manufacturing enterprises. And my concern is provide a framework in which there's availability of supply at reasonable prices where possible.
Well, precisely how do you see the gas issue being resolved? How's the situation going to be improved? Are you saying that the state governments will change their attitude?
Are you saying
the Commonwealth has discretion?
I'm saying that the Commonwealth wants to provide national leadership by engaging them through COAG in looking at ways in which we can free up more of those areas, including what incentives can be provided. And what the latter means, in part, is looking at whether we can better align the interests of landholders with exploration and development companies and the government in working out who gets what out of the development of these resources, because in the past that's been a major source, I think, of frustration from the way landholders in particular feel they've been treated by exploration companies.
Well, what are some options here?
Well, the options that we flagged already in terms of incentives is whether it's possible for, if we're talking about farmers, they get more of a return for resources on their land or under their land, which may be exploited under new gas exploration and development policies.
So the companies developing these resources would pay more to the farmers?
Well, at the moment, these resources would revert to the Crown if they're under the ground or whatever. So we'd have to work, we as in government, Commonwealth and state, would have to work out more appropriate gain-sharing arrangements where possible. Now, some state governments may be reluctant to go there because they're worried about taking on some of their local constituencies. But I think someone has got to provide leadership. And having discussed it around the cabinet table, we believe it's the federal government that should provide the leadership.
So we're just on this point of the farmers getting more. Who would be paying that, would you envisage?
Well, ultimately, it'll come out of the resource.
Right.
And ultimately, that resource provides payments.
So that's the states or the companies, essentially?
Yes, essentially, yes.
So which route would be preferable?
Well, part of the reason for having the discussion at COAG is to work out exactly what is possible. I mean, we've got to test the appetite of the states, but unless someone gets the ball rolling, we won't have any answers to these questions.
But it's easy in a way to get the ball rolling and harder to get it to roll in the direction you want.
Let's get the debate going, and if we at least get the debate, Woody Allen used to say, 80% of life or success is turning up. Well, we're turning up to discuss this issue. We're getting the ball rolling.
Well, we'll hope Woody Allen was right in this instance. Just back on the question of the clean coal,
sure,
new plants, why do you think, if this is such a good idea, why do you think the industry and the finance industry are so sceptical?
Well, I think to be fair to industry, until they see a policy that is worked out, articulated, implemented, they won't have any reason to change their behaviour. So they're responding to the environment they're in at the moment.
But you'd expect them to be grabbing this with both hands if it was such a good idea.
Well, what you'd be expecting is rightly for them to say, well, show us the detail of what you mean, what you're talking about, and we'll go from there.
Now, your new area of industry policy takes you right into the centre of a particular area of disillusionment in the electorate, the feeling that Australia has lost the capacity to be a manufacturing nation, except in niche areas. Do you think it is possible for us to retain substantial critical mass in manufacturing, or do you think it is only going to be in specialist items that we can be competitive internationally?
No, I think we can maintain and should maintain a critical mass in manufacturing. And over the last year, jobs have actually been going up in manufacturing. What I think is important is how you do it. So we're talking about a situation where we are globally competitive, where we have firms which have a global mindset, and this doesn't just apply to manufacturing. It's important for firms to have a global mindset. We don't have the scale of some other countries have in terms of size of market, and that's why we have to look at the global markets. The issue of niche manufacturing comes up because increasingly things are put together in a number of countries and then maybe assembled in one country. So you have a situation where you have to be integral to all these sorts of supply chains. The advantage we've got is that the access of global supply chains is moving to the Asia Pacific in a quite a decisive way. And that gives us a great advantage because we're so near, we're cheek by jowl to the region. So niche is good, critical mass is important. That means continuing to promote higher level skills, science, technology, engineering, maths and the like. Because as we've seen in the automotive sector, as they transition out of assembly here, what they're doing is they are relying on Australia to provide a lot of high-end engineering R&D capability in Victoria and in South Australia. So from my point of view, that high-end manufacturing is good. They're good, high-paid jobs. It'd be great to keep expanding the size of the sector. That's one of the things we want to keep doing. The reason for the critical mass is that that also provides support to our research and other institutions when they're looking at job placement and all the rest of it. So from my point of view, it's quite a broad agenda.
And does the Trump factor and protectionism feed into the dangers for this sort of future?
Well, from our point of view as a government, we are going to argue vociferously, domestically and internationally, the case for free trade or freer trade, the case for free trade agreements, because frankly, trade is good for both sides. And I was with Jack Ma in Melbourne on the weekend at the opening of the Alibaba office there. The important point he made is how good trade is for everybody. It's a mutual exchange. And that's the point we have to keep getting across to people. Yes, we have to deal with some of the impacts of trade on domestic constituencies, and we're going to help people through the adjustment. But trade is a good thing. It's opening up a lot of markets for Australia, and they're the case studies earlier I referred to that we're going to keep pushing.
Now, you're also, as Minister, carrying the innovation ball. A bit of the gloss went off that, I think, during the election campaign when it didn't resonate all that much. We had that statement soon after the Prime Minister took over. But what's the next stage in the innovation agenda?
Well, what's happening at the moment is we've had Innovation and Science Australia do a bit of a report on the state of innovation and science in Australia. They're now going to use that as a basis for setting out a plan to 2030. So I'm talking to Bill Ferris and the board about what that means in terms of our priorities going forward. But I want to build on what we've already done in the National Innovation and Science Agenda, particularly nailing this collaboration piece, greater collaboration between industry, research institutions and government organisations in terms of greater commercialisation of research in Australia in particular, and also governed as an exemplar. For example, we do a lot of military procurement. Defence Investment Program is very big. How do we make sure we maximise the spin-offs from that in terms of high-tech, IP sort of industries, which potentially also provide us with a new export base?
Just finally, to return to the government's rather rough period. You've been through some rough periods when you were Chief of Staff to John Howard. I just wonder whether you find the job of Minister more difficult or less difficult than being Chief of Staff to a Prime Minister.
They all have their challenges. The difference is when you're a Minister, once you've said something and it's escaped from your mouth, you can never take it back. So you always think that 1 second more when you say something. But there are challenges in every job.
Abundant caution.
Absolutely.
Arthur Sinodinos, thank you for talking with us. And that's all for today. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back with you soon. I'm Michelle Grattan. Goodbye for now.